Kairi Mai. Ko Sandra Kailaho, and you're listening to Safe and Sound, an animal rights program broadcasting from Free FM in Hamilton and played right across the country via the Access Radio Sector. We're sponsored by Village Organics, and they've been in touch this week to say that they have fresh, locally grown asparagus in store right now, the only organic certified asparagus available in the North Island, and you can buy that at $5 a bunch. It'll be there until the season finishes mid-December, so if you're like me and you love asparagus, head down to Village Organics opposite Hotel Frankton there in the village. So today I'll be speaking to Ben Pearson of World Animal Protection, formerly known as WHISPA. Ben is the Senior Campaign Manager for Australia and New Zealand, and he's based in Sydney. So instead of the acronym WHISPA, W-S-P-A, the new name clearly spells out who they are and what they stand for, the protection of world animals. Their vision is a world where animal welfare matters and animal cruelty has ended. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thank you for having me.
Can you please tell us what your career path was, sort of leading up to your present position? Have you come fairly recently to animal advocacy?
Yes, I have. I've only actually been in the organisation for this year, but I have spent pretty much my entire life working for non-governmental organisations on environment issues in particular, which of course has obviously a strong animal welfare component to it. But in the past, I've worked for organisations like Greenpeace, I've worked in government, and then I came to this organisation at the beginning of the year.
Now, it used to be called WHISPA. It's now World Animal Protection. When did it all begin? How many years ago?
Oh, WHISPA got going many decades ago. It's actually quite an old organisation. It's been around for ages doing good work. I think the change a couple of years ago to World Animal Protection was really just about changes within the organisation, and we felt that World Animal Protection was a more accurate reflection of the name. But yes, it's a big organisation. It's represented in many countries and has been going for years now, doing just really, really good work. It's one of the reasons I was attracted to getting a job with them and being a part of it.
Yes, I remember, it must be 20 years ago, WHISPA first coming to my attention on the bear issue. It wasn't bear bile farming, I think it was the bear baiting. Would that be right?
That's right. Bear baiting and captive bears. And yes, you're right, bears were a really big part of the early years of the organisation. Mm. We really worked hard and achieved a lot, and have achieved a lot also about the bear bile issue as well. But certainly the conditions that the bears were being kept in and the way they were being treated was just so acutely cruel that it seemed like an obvious focus for some of our early work. But, you know, in addition to that, the early work of the organisation focused on things like protecting animals in disasters, and that's certainly something that we're one of the few organisations globally to do.
I mean,
you know, obviously in disasters people focus very much on humans, which is understandable, but there's also a lot of animals that need help, and sometimes you find that the decisions that humans make about whether they leave a disaster zone or whether they get out ahead of a hurricane or a bushfire is actually determined sometimes by their feelings about leaving their animals behind, be they domestic or livestock.
But there's also wild animals that are affected by these disasters, aren't they? I'm just thinking of the current wildfires in California. How many wild animals are being affected?
Well, that's right, and in some cases it's very hard to know, but even look closer to home. I mean, in Australia, where I'm talking to you from now, when we have those just horrific bushfires, which of course are becoming more common because of climate change, we find that the toll of native wildlife is just horrendous, absolutely horrendous. It's just hard to put an exact number on it, but it must be in the thousands.
Yes, and what a painful and distressing way to die as well if you are a wild animal. We just stay with the organisation for the moment. Now, you're regionally based, aren't you? You have a number of offices right across the world. How are you actually structured? And give us an idea of the amount of people who are working for you, including volunteers.
Sure. So we are an international organisation, as you said. We have offices in across about 20 countries. The head office is in London. We have offices in Australia, New Zealand, Thailand in this region, China as well. But obviously then, you know, again, we will go to other countries to do work if needed. So be it for disaster work or because we want to go and investigate venues that keep wild animals, for example. The number of people who work with us, well, we've got hundreds of people working for us across the world. We also have people who work sort of for us, not as permanent staff, but as consultants. In particular, we have technical experts whom we call on frequently. I mean, I can't stress enough that we are an organisation that prides itself very much on being evidence-based. We do a lot of research that underpins the campaigns that we run, and we pride ourselves on, frankly, getting our facts right, and both about the scale of a problem and also about the solutions that we advocate for. So so that's the organisation in a nutshell. Yeah, the offices all around the world means it gives us so much greater power, particularly when we're, for example, trying to persuade tourists not to go to Thailand and ride elephants. We can really be active in so many markets where those tourists come from.
Mm. Just talking about your campaigns, I saw on your website that basically you work with animals in the wild, animals in communities, animals in disasters, animals in farming, and also working on their behalf in terms of general animal welfare. When I was reading about a current campaign, I was astonished to learn about civet coffee. Can you tell us about that problem?
Of course. So what happens is that the civet animal in Indonesia, the civet cat, will swallow coffee beans, and they're then passed through its gut. And it's a bit of a sort of a local thing that you take these beans and you actually then make coffee out of them. Now, the problem is as it became more and more popular, people were going into the wild and actually capturing the animals and then keeping them in really pretty horrendous conditions so that they could get more beans to offer to tourists and to locals alike. So that's obviously something that we wanted to do something about, primarily because of the conditions that the animals have been kept in, but also just because you just shouldn't keep wild animals in captivity. It's just cruel, inherently cruel. So in that case, that's a good example sometimes of where tourists can go to a country, do something which seems relatively benign, in this case, just drink a cup of coffee with an interesting provenance, but unbeknownst to them, behind the scenes, they're contributing to animal cruelty. And so much of the work that we actually do with the wildlife campaign is a part of a called Wildlife Not Entertainers, which helps expose the reality that so many of the wildlife venues that people go and visit engage in acute cruelty to animals, to these wild animals, and we help educate tourists not to go to those types of venues and be complicit in that.
I have to ask, how does a coffee bean passing through the intestinal tract of a civet, how does it change the taste? Why is it so prized?
It's a mystery to me as well. As a very enthusiastic coffee drinker, it's a mystery to me.
Goodness. I also read that these civets, when they're kept in cages in order to be able to produce the civet coffee, they show signs of great stress. They're pacing backwards and forwards, and they're even harming themselves. They're engaging in self-harm because they're so blimmin' frustrated.
And that's hardly surprising. I mean, what you're saying is absolutely right. We've certainly seen that. It's documented to be the case. People have to remember that these are sentient animals, and by that I mean that they feel pain, they feel distress, they have a level of awareness in that obviously a cat being kept in a cage, absolutely it's going to be stressed, it's going to be distressed by the treatment it's receiving. Yes. We can't pretend somehow that these are, as we used to say, dumb animals. They're not. Right. They're simply not. They feel pain, they feel distress. If you treat them badly, you will upset them, and you just shouldn't be doing that.
Yes, and they're like us. You know, there are nuances in how wild animals feel, just as there are nuances in how you and I feel. There's an emotional sentient continuum in the animal kingdom. Is that right?
That is absolutely right, and it's a really important point you make. We talk, when it comes to animal welfare, about the five freedoms, and four of those freedoms are really freedoms from things, like freedom from pain, freedom from mistreatment, you know, freedom from abuse, from fear, and the like. But there's a fifth freedom, which is actually a positive freedom, and that is the freedom to express natural behaviours. And that's really what you're saying there. Mm. You're absolutely right. I mean, to give you an idea, we keep chickens in large barns nowadays. Yeah. That's a very common way of doing it. And a chicken in its natural habitat will really want to do things like, you know, scratch around at the ground, build a bit of a nest, engage in certain behaviours. Now, if you deny it the right to express those natural behaviours, it's not cruelty in the sense of, say, hitting the chicken or causing it actual physical pain, but by denying it something that it innately wants to do, that is actually cruel. That's stressful for the animal.
Of course.
Another good example, of course, is things such as, say, when we keep dolphins in tanks. Now, the dolphin isn't being mistreated in the sense of harm, or it's not in fear or anything, but obviously in that small tank it can't express natural behaviours, such as living in complex social groups, swimming really large distances, diving deeply. So it's that fifth freedom is a really important one, and it's something that we focus on particularly in our farming campaign, that even if you are keeping an animal in a farming facility, it doesn't mean that you can't try to create conditions in which that animal can actually express natural behaviours and at least for the length of the life that it has, it can have a good life. And that's really important. We focus on that a lot, the idea that even animals in farming should have a life worth living.
Right. Another one of your campaign headings is animals and communities. I've actually spent quite a lot of time in India and I'm very familiar with a really heartbreaking problem of stray dogs. They're everywhere and they live alongside people. They don't live with them, but, you know, they're on the streets, they're outside of shops and they're homeless, they're nameless, they're often hungry, they're often thirsty. It's a very, very sad situation. And I think that there are many places in the developing world where these poor, often disease-ridden, unwanted, unloved, hungry and thirsty dogs present a real problem. But there is an answer, isn't there?
Well, that's right. And I'm also, very much I feel a real affinity for that campaign because I used to live in Bali. And the street dogs in Bali are the same. They're really painful to see, quite frankly. You know, they're said in such poor condition.
Yes.
And there are answers to that. I mean, you know, sterilisation campaigns is certainly one thing we do. The second thing, of course, is that in Bali and in countries like that, sometimes those dogs also have rabies, which means that it's not just that the animal is in distress, but they can also pose a risk to the local human population as well. Engaging in rabies vaccinations is also something that we've done in the past. We do that also because, unfortunately, in the past we've seen dog culling being used as a solution. You know, numbers get too much, complaints are made, and so the local authorities will go around and just cull the animals, and sometimes they do it in ways which are hardly humane. So controlling the populations through sterilisation is certainly something that makes a lot of sense.
And I suppose there's a certain amount of education of local people as well?
Yes, I think that sometimes comes into it. It really depends. I think that's country by country. But I think that's right. It can be. There's always that fine line between telling other people how they should live their lives in their own country, and education. But certainly that can be a part of it.
Yeah. You mentioned before about how climate change is affecting animals as well. And there's no doubt that we're seeing many more extreme events. The current Californian crisis is an example of this, but floods and droughts and more natural disasters. I've been told that volcanoes and earthquakes are not related to global warming, but there are more of those happening as well. And of course, the animals in these disaster zones are the focus of your attention as well. Can you give us some examples of that?
Absolutely. So the recent hurricanes that went through the Caribbean and then up to Southern America, we were active in those countries helping out there. And it's twofold, really. I mean, we see two main problems there. The first is that sometimes you'll see, even in bushfires in Australia, where people have died going back to get their animals. Or you see a situation where people have been not sure what to do about their pets, and as a result, their pets have actually, you know, suffered injury or died. And we have a Protect Your Pet program, which actually says, here's a plan that you can do, which actually gets you prepared for a natural disaster so that you're thinking not only about how to protect you and your property, but your pet in the event that a disaster happens. What we also do, though, is we go into places like that. We provide veterinary care. We help actually, you know, just help the animals on the ground sometimes that have been separated from their owners. But we also do preemptive work. So we were active recently in Mongolia, where there's this incredibly severe winter with this winter weather system called the Dzud. We went in there beforehand to work with communities to get them ready, so that they were able to protect their animals from these extreme cold that was coming through. But then also, you find that as well as, say, companion animals or in that situation, the Dzud and the rest, there's also the problem, of course, that you have situations where you're helping people to protect their livestock, not just because of the animal welfare imperative, but also because in a lot of developing countries,
they depend
livestock
on them.
Isn't exactly. That's very much a lot of a person's wealth and capital is tied up in those. And it was interesting recently when the Mount Agung in Bali looked like exploding. I saw some interviews with local villagers who were refusing to leave the area around the volcano, and they were saying explicitly, I'm not going because then there won't be anyone to look after my animals. And, you know, essentially their animals, as I say, are one of their key sources of wealth. So us going in there is both an animal welfare measure, but also it's something which actually helps the community as a whole by helping them to look after their animals.
Mm. Another one of your areas of work is with animals and farming, and I think you probably realise that as an animal rights show that we have the attitude that we shouldn't be farming animals at all. But your campaigns are focused on, well, for example, encouraging the general public to buy food that's in line with the highest welfare standards, and you'd be against factory farming.
That's right. So our approach to farming is this. The reality is that every year on this planet, about 70 billion animals are farmed. Mm-hmm. That is, they are killed in a facility and they're eaten by humans. 60 billion are chickens. It's quite amazing figures. The numbers are really huge. The reality is that as more people in the world become wealthier, become middle class, the demand for animal protein also will increase. Now, we think that given that situation, our focus is on making sure that the animals on farms or in facilities actually have a life worth living. The conditions in those facilities should be such that the animals have a life worth living, that they are, there are not mutilations, which sometimes happens, de-beaking and the like, that the animals, the chickens have enough space to move around, they get natural light, they have the ability to express natural behaviours. We're also keen, for example, on, we'd like to see the chicken industry using breeds of chickens that aren't as fast growing and cause welfare concerns. Pigs, for example, is another one we're really focusing on now. And again, we don't want to see female pigs in sow stalls. Mm. We'd like to see the farrowing crates, which are used when they have piglets, after they have piglets, phased out. And we'd like to see a whole bunch of what we call enrichments offered to pigs and express some natural behaviours in that regard. So those kind of things also are really important. So it's saying to people, you should be basically trying to source meat that comes from places where the animal welfare standards are as high as possible.
Let's look now at the way you might be lobbying agricultural organisations, United Nations and so on, to make positive changes for animals in all these different areas.
We do have some involvement with those kind of multilateral fora, particularly CITES, the Convention on the Trade in Endangered Species. It actually lists some of the animals which we sometimes find in these welfare wildlife venues overseas. So obviously we're active in fora like that, trying to ensure that member states are actually doing what they've signed up to do, which is actually protect the animals listed under that convention. Beyond that, yes, we also, for example, are active in various fora around things like trying to clean up ghost gear from the world's oceans, which is a major threat to marine animals and the like. But when it comes to things like farm animals in particular, the focus is very much on a national level, sometimes even a state level. And when it comes to wildlife venues, venues where they're keeping wildlife for entertainment, we also then focus primarily at the moment on travel companies and also individual tourists, try to educate them and change their behaviour. We do work with the Thai government and the Indian government, where a lot of these venues are located, but the main way in which we try to achieve change is by getting travel companies and tourists to do the right thing.
Right. You've got a good website there, and I read about the work you've done with elephants and also monkeys who's forced to dress up and perform tricks, with sloths, with toucans, with anacondas, crocodiles, anteaters. Yeah, a lot that you're doing to help these animals who, as you say, are sentient, are interested in living their own natural lives, and who are often suffering terribly at our hands.
Yeah, and they certainly are. And it's really something where we feel that animal welfare is one of those issues where people are now really starting to become much more aware of it.
Yes.
And we're really aware now, people are starting to get that, yes, I shouldn't go to a venue and ride an elephant. I shouldn't go to a venue where a dolphin is kept captive in a pool. I should be mindful of the fact that if I am going to buy chicken tonight at the supermarket for my family, I should make the effort to make sure that it comes from somewhere where that animal at least had a life worth living. So we feel that that kind of thing is positive. We see that not just in surveys we do, manifested in surveys we do, but also because we notice that major retailers, major supermarkets are also now, starting to do the right thing. Certainly in Australia, put pressure on the suppliers to start to lift their animal welfare standards. And they're doing that because they're hearing that very clearly from their customers, that they're starting to think about this a bit more.
Yeah. I will put up a link on our Facebook page. I'll put up a link to your website, and I'd like you to tell us how we can support your work.
primarily the main thing we really need is donations. We only, you know, our funding raising is reliant on members of the public giving us money, and we have a number of supporters who do that, and that's extremely welcome. The more money we have, the more effective
the more
we can be for animals.
Yeah.
That's right. But then also, please do go to our webpage, worldanimalprotection.org.au. I think it's different in New Zealand, but I know you'll paste it on your Facebook page.
Yeah.
There's a page there which tells you how you can take action across all of our campaigns. And that's really, really, really important. You know, a country like New Zealand, you are a parliamentary democracy. It's really important that average New Zealanders are telling their government that they do want to see higher welfare standards in New Zealand, you know, that they'd like to see the end of live exports, that they'd like to see whichever party forms power, introducing, say,
we still don't
an independent.
Know
that's right. That, you know, they'd like to see them have even tougher animal welfare standards.
Right.
But also, you know, make sure that as an individual you do the right thing. If you're going to go overseas on a holiday, make sure you have a look at the kind of travel companies we recommend you use, which will make sure that you don't go to venues which support animal cruelty. And of course, if you are a person who buys meat, as I said, make sure that you're buying that meat from somewhere where animal welfare standards are high. So there's really a lot you can do.
A lot the individual can do.
Yep, absolutely.
Thank you, Ben. It's been lovely talking with you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All the best.
It just occurred to me that by the time this show goes to air, we may know who the new government of New Zealand is. And whichever one it is, Ben's right in that we can influence the lives of animals in this country by raising our voices to say that animal lives matter, that we care about them, and that the government of the day should too. Of course, I believe the best way to help animals is to go vegan. And don't forget that SAFE are continuing their campaign asking people to try out veganism for a month, and they'll support you with recipes and that kind of thing. So if you want to know more about that, head to safe.org.nz and follow the links there. It's just come to my attention that in the Orini, Taupri, Huntly area, Mainland Poultry have applied for consent to operate an egg layer facility proposed to contain 800,000 caged chickens. 800,000, that's getting on to 1 million chickens in 17 sheds with 50,000 chickens in each shed, up to 5 cages high. So, I mean, quite apart from the animals, the facility is bound to affect the community in terms of added noise and pollution. There'll be more flies around, there'll be a strong smell probably, and additional traffic on an already busy road. And of course, property values will be affected. So if you live in that area, then maybe that's something that you need to find out more about. Personally speaking, I think that it's a real anachronism to be even thinking of building such a place. It's completely going against the spirit of the times. Things are changing rapidly, even more than we thought possible, even a couple of years ago. Ben mentioned about the astronomical numbers that chickens are farmed in worldwide, and it's true that chickens are, in terms of numbers, by far the most abused animal on the planet. And so I certainly hope that this place never sees the light of day. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And that sounds exactly like a song coming on. So let's listen now to John Lennon, Imagine. And until next week, Mati wa. Go well, everyone. Bye-bye.
Imagine there's no heaven. See if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky. Imagine there's no countries.
You've been listening to Safe and Sound, an animal rights program recorded at Free FM in Hamilton and broadcast through stations in the New Zealand Community Access Radio sector. You can follow the show via their Facebook page, which is Safe and Sound Radio Show and Podcast. And you can download and listen to past episodes by going to accessradio.org or through Apple Podcasts.